Hello and welcome to Physics 102 lecture for September 30th, 2009. I apologize for not getting this lecture on before the nominal lecture time. It's actually, the lecture should nominally be ending right now, and I'm only just now finding a chance to record it. At any rate, I feel like quite the idiot sitting in a hotel room talking to myself at the moment, but oh well, that's one of the drawbacks of this particular system. It does manifest itself somewhat in, it's hard to joke around when you're talking to yourself, or maybe it's a good thing that I find it that way. At any rate, so what that means is that the lecture will probably be a little bit drier, and I'll probably cover the material a bit faster than I would normally, so I don't know that this will really go the full hour and 15 minutes. I have about a certain point that I'd like to get to, and if I get there earlier, then I'll just stop earlier. At any rate, you should be able to find the PDF file containing the slides that I'll be describing in this talk. I'll be referring to it. The name of the file is p102_093009, and the link should be live on the web. So, to get started, I wanted to talk about what's happening next week. We have no class next Monday because we're having our fall break. So that means that we have no lecture Monday. We also have no recitation next Monday. We will go ahead and meet our recitations on Tuesday and Friday. So what I'll do is I'll basically start the next cycle for the workshop or for the recitations on the Tuesday rather than starting the new one on Monday. And so the cycle will go Tuesday, Friday, Monday. And we'll just go from there until something else causes the schedule to change. Okay, so if you go to slide 2 in the PDF file meant to accompany this, I want to review a little bit what we did last time. Remember that we have talked about Maxwell's equations, and in the late 1800s, James Clerk Maxwell and other physicists that I really haven't talked about, Maxwell being the one who in name really pulled everything together, these physicists established beyond any doubt that light is a wave phenomenon. And it's a strange phenomenon where the electric and magnetic fields do the waving. So typically, waves are certainly well understood in classical physics, and there's a very characteristic form of an equation that describes how a wave moves, basically describes particles moving up and down, and there's connectedness, so the waveform will propagate. And in Maxwell's equations, when they are, it is possible to take them and show that the electric fields and the magnetic fields can satisfy wave equations, and in fact that they're tied together, so that if you have an electric field waving, it also causes a magnetic field to wave. And so we call these things electromagnetic oscillations or electromagnetic waves. And what comes out of this classical physics and Maxwell's equations is a very rich spectrum of electromagnetic waves, which I illustrate for you at the bottom of page 2, where I'm plotting horizontally the wavelength in meters for the different types of electromagnetic waves that we believe exist. And there's not really an end that we know of really on either side of the scale. So you can have extremely long wavelengths down to extraordinarily short wavelengths. And the visible light, which you see around a wavelength of 10 to the minus 6 meters, is only a very small portion of the electromagnetic spectrum. So At shorter wavelengths, you have ultraviolet light, X-rays, and gamma rays, and at longer wavelengths, we have infrared light, microwaves, and radio waves. And these different types of waves, by virtue of the amount of energy that they carry and the wavelength itself, they will interact differently with matter. Let me think for just a second about... A way to think about the fact that they interact differently with matter, you could imagine that the light is characterized by its wavelength, and if you bounce light off of an object that is much smaller than the wavelength of the light really can't image it. It's almost as if it doesn't really see it. A way to think about that would be, suppose you had a shoe on the floor and you were trying to create an image of the shoe or on the wall behind the shoe. This is sort of a silly thing. But suppose that you want to create this image of the shoe by looking at how the shoe shadows the wall behind it. And instead of using light, we use particles. So let's say we use BBs. You could take a bucket of BBs and roll them toward the shoe, and basically the shoe would screen off the region directly behind it, so that the BBs would only hit the wall to the sides of the shoe, and in a sense, the shadow of the shoe on the wall would give you an image of the shoe. But not a good image, but basically you'd see something about the size of the shoe on the wall. But if I tried the same trick with bowling balls, right, it's not going to work at all. The bowling balls basically would pass all around the shoe, but you're not going to get a crisp shadow of the shoe against the wall. So in a sense, when an object is approximately the size of the wavelength of the light smaller than the wavelength of the light, the light doesn't really interact with it very, very easily. And there are other reasons why light interacts differently, which we'll get to shortly when we get into the quantum mechanics side of things. But there are classical effects that really have to do with diffraction, which we've already talked about a little bit. That, for example, waves passing through a thin slit are spread out if that thin slit is on the order of or smaller than the wavelength. But if that slit is vastly larger than the wavelength, then the waves basically pass right through. It's another way of sort of saying what I'm trying to say about the shoe analogy. Classically, you can't image something if it is smaller than or equal to the wavelength of the light. So as the wavelength of the light changes, your ability to use it as a tool differs, in part because of that and other reasons that we'll talk about a little bit today. So it's a very rich spectrum, and we have learned to detect all of these different types of electromagnetic radiation and can use them for different things that will come up from time to time throughout the course. If you would go to slide 3, once you say that something is a wave, you actually are saying a lot more than just that. Waves have very particular characteristics. Waves exhibit interference, where you can sort of think of that as the height of the waves add together as they reach each other. So if you have a trough of a wave hits a peak of a different wave, they sort of cancel each other out. And if the two peaks hit each other, then they add together. This is known as interference. Another phenomenon that all waves exhibit is known as diffraction, and that's basically what I was just describing. If a wave goes through a thin slit, it will spread out. Another phenomenon, which is responsible for eyeglasses and lenses, among other things, is known as refraction. And for refraction, if the wave hits a surface, an interface between two different media, and what I mean by that, for example, would be air and glass. Both are transparent to visible light, for example, but they are different to the light. And although we haven't made a big deal out of it, it turns out that if you look at Maxwell's equations in materials, that light actually travels more slowly in transparent materials like glass or plastic than it does in a vacuum. And because of this difference, if light is coming into glass at an angle, that it will actually get bent. And there are very particular rules that we're not going to worry about how the light is bent, but it's very well understood, and it comes straight out of Maxwell's equations. Although the laws of optics were understood beforehand, they can be derived from Maxwell's equations. You can calculate, for example, how a certain shape of a lens made out of a certain material, what will happen to the light as it passes through it. So this is a very important thing in terms of current technology. On page 3, you'll see a few URLs that you might want to poke around and play with. Another thing that light exhibits, which we'll talk about a good bit, is something known as dispersion. So what I show down at the bottom of page 3, basically the cross-section of a prism, and I show that a black line coming into it from the left, which you can think of as a ray of light. And as the ray of light hits the edge of the prism, it is an interface between air and glass, and the ray of light is bent, as I've shown in the picture. And then the ray of light leaves, it is also bent. Well, it turns out that the degree to which the light is bent depends on the frequency of the light, and this particular phenomenon is known as dispersion. But what that allows us to do is to use a prism to frequency analyze the light beam. So we can have a ray of light incident on the prism, and it gets split into its separate colors. And we'll find that this is an extremely powerful tool for trying to understand the structure of matter, and it'll turn out to be a tool that we can use to great advantage in understanding and identifying different types of matter in different settings, including in the atmosphere of stars and things. So we'll come back to that very soon. If you go to page 4, if you go to page 4, all that I've said up till now and a little bit at the end of last class, light is a wave. It's known to be a wave. Mathematically, it works as a wave. There are experiments out the wazoo that show that it exhibits wave characteristics that can be calculated exactly. So there's no doubt that light is a wave. So people wanted to use light to understand the structure of matter, and the simplest thing they could do would be to look at the glow of light coming from a heated object, in a sense. If you look at the reflection of light from an object, you may be learning something about the material the object is made of, but you're also sensitive to the source of the light and the spectrum of light that's emitted by the source of the light that reflects off of the object. So a way to look at just the characteristics of the object itself is to isolate it from reflected light and look at the glow of the light that's coming from it. Now, it may sound a little bit strange to talk about a glow that you maybe can't see. Think of a glowing hot fireplace poker or a glowing oven burner. As you add heat to this system, as you give them lots of energy, they'll actually glow. And as they get hotter, they'll go from red to to blue. But it turns out that they will glow also in frequencies that your eye cannot see. So even when they are cool, they're glowing, but they're just glowing in a frequency that you don't see. At any rate, people took a lot of data trying to understand the structure of matter and how it glows to see if they could come up with a model using the wave theory for light and the idea, knowing that matter is made of electric charges, trying to figure out how to jiggle the charges basically in a way that would create the frequencies of light that were observed. And it turns out that that physicists were unable to reproduce the spectrum of this so-called the spectrum of light from a glowing object is something we call black body radiation. Black body because basically you're putting the body, you're only looking at light that's coming from it and not reflecting off of it. So it's as if you put it in a box that's completely black and you look through a pinhole or something like that. But at the bottom, I plot the intensity of the light on the vertical axis versus the wavelength on the horizontal axis for different temperature objects. And what you see is that as you go to higher temperatures, the amount of light emitted or the intensity of the light becomes greater. So the purple curve is higher than the red curve, for example. But another thing you'll see is that the peak position moves. It moves from longer wavelengths to shorter wavelengths. So that's another way of saying that when things are at lower temperatures, they're redder, and as you go to higher temperatures, they become bluer to your eye because the amount of light that's being emitted in the blue frequencies is greater at that point. At any rate, the physics community absolutely failed to reproduce these curves, theoretically, using all this information from Maxwell. And this was a bit of a crisis in physics. A physicist named Max Planck came up with a formula that describes the behavior of light coming from a black body exactly. The problem was that what he came up with, the way he came up with it, he made an assumption that was very strange. If you go to slide 5, Planck succeeded in describing black body radiation, but in order to do so, he assumed that the light comes in little packets, and the packets have very particular energy. The energy of each packet is proportional to its frequency, and the constant of proportionality is something that basically he determined by looking at the data and finding what value it had to be in order for the curves to fit the data. And we now call that number Planck's constant, and it's literally just a number with the right unit. So if you frequency is in 1 over seconds in the equation on page 5, energy is in a unit which is called electron volts, which I'll talk about in a few minutes. And so Planck's constant would be, for example, in units of energy times seconds, so that it ends up, when you multiply it by the frequency, you end up with energy. At any rate, this is very strange what Planck did, right? Because everybody knows light is a wave. Waves are not particles, right? Particles are at a specific place at a specific time. If you go to the beach and I ask you, where is the wave? I mean, you might point to a wave and say, well, it's there, but if I ask you specifically, show me, you know, where is the very center, the core, the essence of this wave, you can't really point to that because the wave is basically a diffuse object. So conceptually, we don't think of waves as particles at all. And then, of course, particles are not at all waves, right? Particles are more like marbles or BBs, and there's no wave there. So this whole idea doesn't make any sense, since we know that light is a wave. And strangely enough, though, Planck found that by assuming that, by basically ignoring the wave characteristics except by assigning a frequency to the light, he assumes that light is just made of these little packets of energy. And each packet of energy has an an amount of energy which is equal to h times the frequency for that particular packet. So it's completely crazy idea, and pretty much what happened was that the community of physicists quickly understood that his equation, final equation that described the blackbody spectra, was absolutely correct in its form. They basically dismissed his way of deriving it as fortuitous. Nobody really took this idea that light comes in little packets seriously, because there was a tremendous amount of success that had been all experiments, everything where light was thought to be a wave was very successful. So if you go to slide 6 now, things were a bit of a confused mess until 1905, and perhaps even somewhat after that, but things got resolved a little in 1905, again by our friend Einstein. There was another phenomenon that had been discovered about 20 years earlier called the photoelectric effect. And the photoelectric effect basically is, if I have a heavy metal like gold or tin or lead or something, and I shine light on it, sometimes, depending on the nature, the intensity and or frequency of the light, I can eject electrons from the metal. So a way to think about it is, I could have a piece of metal sitting near a wire, and I could put an electric field across the metal to the wire, and no current will flow because of the air between the wire and the metal. But now if I hit the metal with light of certain characteristics, it can actually cause electrons to be ejected from the metal and go to the wire and cause a current to flow. So that's one way of thinking about it. Let's not worry really about how we're detecting the electrons, but the point is, if I shine light on heavy metals, I can get electrons to be ejected. So people studied this phenomenon, and they tried to understand how the number and energy of the electrons that were emitted when you shine light on the metal, how the number and energy of those electrons depended on the intensity and frequency of the light that you shine on it. And what they found was that the electric current, or the amount of electrons that get kicked off the metal, depends basically on the frequency of the light. And the energy of the electrons coming off also depends on the frequency. Above a certain frequency, the number of electrons can depend on the intensity of the light. But this turns out to be contradictory to what you would expect with Maxwell. If you think of light as a basic classical wave, which is what everybody believed in, then if you picture an electron sitting in the metal, what's happening is that the electron is bound due to electric attraction inside the metal. You know, there are nuclei in the metal that are positive, and basically they're holding on to their electrons. And if you give that electron enough energy, it will have enough energy to be ejected from the metal. A way to think about it is, something that is gravitationally bound to the Earth, for example, if we give it enough energy, it basically can escape Earth's orbit. So that's sort of a picture that you could have: the electrons in the metal, if you give them enough energy, they'll pop out. Classically, the wave theory basically says it doesn't really matter what the frequency of the light is or what the energy is of the wave that's coming in. If I wait long enough, enough energy will be integrated in the electron that some of them will be ejected. So as I go to more and more energetic light, I should be ejecting more electrons simply because it takes less time for them to integrate enough energy to be popped out. But if I go to less and less energetic light, I'll still eject electrons, just fewer of them. It turns out that what you see experimentally is no matter how bright or how long you wait or how bright the light, if you shine light on a metal below a certain frequency, you will never eject electrons. And if you increase the frequency of the light, you'll reach a certain point, a threshold point, where you'll begin to eject electrons. And this makes no sense from the point of view of the classical wave picture. So people were very puzzled by this so-called photoelectric effect. In 1905, Einstein published a paper, and again, this is one of his 1905 papers that, I mean, it was an incredible year for him. One paper was special relativity, another paper was also special relativity, but one, I think, was talking more about space-time, another talked about energy and matter. So, in a sense, one revolutionized our theory of space and time, the other revolutionized our understanding of energy and mass. And the first one that did the space and time also revolutionized our understanding of Maxwell's equations. It didn't change them, but it gave us more knowledge about it. Then this paper is the photoelectric effect, which really, to a large extent, launched quantum theory. And the reason why is the following. Einstein was able to explain the photoelectric effect by assuming that light came in little packets. Again, these packets having energy H nu. And if you think about it, the picture that Einstein has is you're shooting these packets of energy at the electrons, and if that packet of energy is absorbed by the electron and there's enough energy there, the electron is ejected. If that packet of energy does not have enough energy, if the packet of light does not have enough energy to eject the electron, it's not absorbed, or it just doesn't eject the electron at all. And so if you, in this picture, there would be a threshold frequency below which the packets of energy have too little energy to eject the electrons, and above which the packets of energy have enough energy to eject the electrons. And as you go up in frequency, they not only eject the electrons, they give them kinetic energy as the electrons come off with more and more energy. So this picture, it turns out, explained the data exactly. And what is even more bizarre is that, again, Einstein had to make the assumption in order to fit the photoelectric data that the energy is proportional to the frequency. And when the photoelectric effect was measured carefully enough, it was determined that the constant of proportionality was, again, the same number H. So it wasn't just that Einstein showed or had to hypothesize light comes in packets. He did. But again, the exact mathematical description of the energy in those packets was exactly the same as what we have in Planck's law and Planck's theory. So it's, in retrospect, and I think to some extent at the time, it was all of a sudden people could no longer take the particle picture of light. They couldn't ignore it, because all of a sudden from two completely independent sources you have these phenomena that could be accounted for by the assumption that light comes in little packets. An imperfect analogy that I use sometimes for this is, if you recall back on a disastrous day in 2001, September 11th, I recall being on the phone. My wife had called me and said that there was news reports of a plane having hit one of the World Trade Center towers. And what came to my mind was a small Piper Cub or something had hit it. And she said, no, it looked like a bigger plane. And I was dubious, because I thought, well, you know, who's going to run a... I mean, the pilots are very good, so it's probably highly unlikely. And while she was on the phone, she said, oh, my God, the other tower was just hit by a plane. And at that moment, I just got cold chills because I knew it was the first plane was not an accident at that point, right? You could have an accident. You might have one plane hitting the tower because somebody screwed up, but you're not going to have two towers hit, you know, within a close proximity in time or anything like that. So in a sense, you could ignore Planck's assumption and assume that he comes up with the right formula for some fortuitous thing. But now you have the exact same assumption working for the photoelectric effect. So clearly the particulate nature of light was here to stay. So on page 7, I show how the energy of the electron for the photoelectric effect in the vertical axis depends on the frequency of the light. So as the frequency increases, the energy of the photon increases, and you get no electrons ejected until you reach this threshold frequency. And then you have the frequency, the energy of the electrons is increasing as you go up in frequency. Okay. So, at any rate, these two completely independent sources find the same H. You define light as having little packets of H nu and energy. And so clearly this is telling us something. Well, so if we go to page 8, so we have this really strange situation. We have Maxwell's equations and interference and refraction and diffraction, and all of these things show very clearly that light is a wave. At the same time, we have blackbody radiation and the photoelectric effect that show us very clearly that light comes in little packets with energy equal H nu. So light is a wave and light is a particle. And there's not really a good way to avoid that. And the fact is, it bothers people. It bothers all people when they learn about this, because we have concepts of particles and concepts of waves that are very distinct and basically contradictory conceptually. But nature really isn't so bothered. So one of the things that we've talked about in this class is that great advances in science have come about from shedding the human bias. And here's an example where we're having to shed our human bias that waves and particles are distinct things. What is important when you're doing a calculation or a scientific experiment, what is important when you're dealing with light, generally, is that you will have to take into account either the wave characteristics of the light or the particle characteristics of the light. We don't really think of having both simultaneously, but nature manages to pull it off. And so, as strange as it may seem, light's a wave, light's a particle. Some people have called light a wavicle, if you wish. So it's really a very revolutionary thing, and people were just, it was sort of shoved down people's throats. So let's go to slide 9. So as we say, light has waves and particle properties. Remember that light is a wave, which means there's a relationship between the frequency and the velocity given by the equation on the upper right of this slide. It's also a particle, so it comes in little packets with energy equal to H nu. And it turns out that basically both of these equations are true for light, period. If you're thinking of it as a particle, if that's what you have to do to understand things, you'll use the lower equation. If you're taking advantage of its wave characteristics, you use the upper equation. And note that the frequency is in both, so you can talk about, for example, if you have a certain wavelength of light, like microwaves, you can ask what is the energy of the packets carried by the microwave. So you use the wavelength and the speed of light to calculate the frequency, and then you can use the frequency to calculate the energy of the packets of the microwave light. As weird as that seems, you're using the wave characteristics of the light to get the frequency, and then from the frequency you can get the energy of the little packets. We call the packets of light photons, and this was a word coined by a chemist named Gilbert Lewis in 1926. And he had a theory about light. He sort of thought of light particles as existing all the time, and so he thought, well, they deserve a name, sort of like an electron has a name. Turns out that we don't really view light in that way, as it goes from one point to another. We view the photon as being created, and then when it's absorbed, it's destroyed. So although the photon doesn't stick around, the name has stuck. So Gilbert's work has lived on in that way. So go to slide 10. All right. At this point, I really have to do a little bit of a detour and talk about units that we're going to be using in when we talk about light and when we talk about particle mass and everything. The unit of energy in the MKS system, which is the basic metric system that you learned in high school chemistry, is called the joule. So this is the basic scientific system of units that people use throughout the world. The MKS, where length is in meters, mass is in kilograms, and time is in seconds. And the joule being being the unit of energy in the MKS system is useful for normal everyday things, like I'm throwing a baseball or heating a house, you know, asking how many joules that takes or kilojoules or whatever, that makes sense. It turns out, though, that a joule is very big on the scale of energies of individual particles or packets of light. So there is a unit of energy which is called the electron volt, or the EV, which turns out to be particularly useful for particle masses and light and things that do with subatomic particles and atoms. One electron volt is equal to 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 joules. So it's a very, very tiny bit of energy compared to sort of everyday energies that you have to deal with. And the way it's defined and where it gets its name is if you look at the diagram at the bottom on page 10, you can imagine taking a little wire, wires, and connecting them across a 1-volt battery. And the wires lead to little plates, and the battery basically charges up the plates, and when you get the electric field that goes across from the negative from the positive plate to the negative plate, basically in this picture, if you were to let an electron go from the surface of the negative plate, it will be attracted toward the positive plate. And because it is experiencing a force as it moves from one plate to the other, it's gaining energy, right? It's going faster and faster. If it has a force, it's accelerating. If it's accelerating, it's going faster and faster. So it's gaining in energy. And the amount of energy it gains when it goes across this gap where the charge is set by a 1-volt battery is known as 1 electron volt. So it may sound a little bit crazy, but it turns out that if you're trying to study electrical things or things with subatomic particles, basically you accelerate particles by doing exactly this kind of game. You take a power source or a big battery, and you charge up a couple of plates, and then that will accelerate charged particles from one plate to another. So you can create beams of particles using basically battery-like devices. So experimentally, it turns out that this sort of makes sense, this whole electron volt idea of energy and how we find it. It turns out to be the scale of energy for most chemical processes and nuclear processes. At least it's a reasonable unit of energy for that. If we go to slide 11, most chemical processes tend to be for individual chemical interactions, tend to deal with energies of electron volts and tens of electron volts. X-rays tend to have energies of thousands of electron volts. Things that are nuclear, if we have a nuclear interaction, it tends to deal with energies of millions of electron volts. So we tend to use these units a lot, thousands of electron volts, millions of electron volts, billions of electron volts, etc. And so we give them shorthand. Thousands of electron volts are kilo electron volts, or KeV. Millions of electron volts are MeV. Billions of electron volts basically are giga electron volts, or GeV. Thousands of billions are TeV. If we use Einstein's equation, which is denoted by the A in a pink circle, E equals mc squared. Remember, this comes out of special relativity, and it just simply says that mass is a form of energy. So that means that a unit of mass is equal to a unit of energy divided by c squared, as a way to think about it. So in the world of particle physics, where we're dealing with lots of particles with different masses, it turns out that the masses we tend, that the unit that we typically use are electron volts, or millions of electron volts over c squared. So you'll see this unit a lot. So the electron mass, for example, the electron has an extraordinarily small mass. I forget the exact number, and I don't have a book with me right now. Basically, 10 to the minus 31 kilograms or something like that. It's not a very convenient unit. On the other hand, it's a half a million electron volts over c squared, if you want to use the MeV over c squared unit. So that's more convenient. So what happens is that in particle physics and cosmology and things, we tend to use the units of masses of particles in electron volts or millions of electron volts over c squared. And very often people will actually ignore the c squared. So this is another example of job security and making things sort of hard to understand by simply having a convention that unless you're in it, you don't realize it. We simply ignore the c squared. So it is very common for people to talk about the mass of an electron being 0.511 MeV. Even though an MeV is a unit of energy, the over c squared is often just sort of understood. So people will talk, you know, so you'll hear reference or see reference to particle masses being in MeV or things like that. Okay, so let's go to slide 12. The next crazy step in this business happened in the mid-1920s when a doctoral student named De Broglie hypothesized that matter can have wave characteristics. I mean, a photon can have particle characteristics. I mean, a light, which is known to be a wave, can have particle characteristics, so why can't matter, known to be particles, have wave characteristics? And the De Broglie wavelength is given by the formula shown by the H in a pink circle. The De Broglie wavelength of a particle is equal to Planck's constant over the momentum of the particle, or H over mv, if you will, because momentum is mass times velocity. And this may seem pretty crazy initially because, right, particles are like BBs, so how can a particle have a wavelength? So let's just look down at the bottom of page 12 to see how this comes about. From special relativity, there is an equation which I did not derive for you, but it's where you have the A in a pink circle. There is the more general expression of E equals mc square, which is valid when the particle is actually moving. E equals mc square is really only true when the particle's at rest. We talked the m there is known as the rest mass. If the particle is moving, then it has a velocity, which means it has a momentum. And when you include the momentum in Einstein's treatment, you get the equation given by the pink A. The mass of a photon is actually zero. So that means Einstein's expression is given by E equals pc, where you have the pink B in a pink circle. Or if I rearrange it, the momentum is equal to E over C of a photon. And so it may seem a little bit strange to talk about the momentum of the photon, but photons do carry momentum, and it's equal to energy over C. Now, if we go down to the bottom from the black body and photoelectric effect, from black body radiation and photoelectric effect, we know that E equals H nu, pink D. We also know that if we look at light as a wave, V is equal to lambda nu, pink E. And if I combine these two and basically setting nu in each of these expressions to... If I combine these two expressions, basically getting rid of nu, I find the equation given by the pink F, E equals hc over nu. Or E over C is equal to H over nu. So now I have, where I have the orange circles at the bottom of this page, page 12, the pink C and the pink F, these two expressions are both equal to E over C, so I can set P is equal to H nu. So this is basically a derivation of the de Broglie wavelength of a photon, and de Broglie's revolutionary statement was, well, so maybe this is also true for particles with mass. And this turns out to be as revolutionary a statement as the idea that a known wave, like light, can have particle characteristics. So before we go on with what this caused, let's do an example. You might ask, wait a minute. I mean, I see particles all the time, and they don't have wavelengths, right? I mean, they don't fuzz out. If I see a car, it doesn't look like a wave. And this is all true. So go to page 13. Let's calculate the wavelength of a baseball. A baseball tends to have it has a mass of 142 grams. And a good baseball pitcher can throw a baseball at 92 miles per hour, or if I calculate that in meters per second, it's 41 meters per second. So that means that the momentum of a baseball is the mass times the velocity, or 5.7 kilogram meters per second. The wavelength of a 92 mile per hour baseball is equal to Planck's constant, which if I put it in units of energy with joules. So in joule seconds, Planck's constant is equal to 6.6 times 10 to the minus 34. And if I divide that by the momentum of the baseball, then I get a number for the wavelength according to de Broglie's relationship that is 1 times 10 to the minus 34 meters. Well, you can't see a wave that's 1 times 10 to the minus 34 meters in wavelength, right? I mean, so what that means is that, according to de Broglie, a baseball does have a wavelength. It's just wavelength is so short, you don't notice it. You don't see the waviness part of it. It's incredibly small. So that means that for normal everyday objects, de Broglie's hypothesis basically is meaningless. It doesn't do anything. If we go to page 14, let us calculate the wavelength for a 1 electron volt, an electron. So an electron that we've given 1 electron volt energy. Now I've painted the picture for how you might do this. Just, it's the energy of an electron that would go from one side of a battery to another, for example. The energy of that electron, if we convert the 1 electron volt into joules, is 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 joules. And if I take that energy and equate it to an expression for the kinetic energy of things, which is 1/2 mv squared, which we've not seen in this class, if I were to find an expression for the amount of energy carried by an object that is moving at a velocity v, it turns out that the expression that you get is 1/2 times its mass times the velocity squared. And it's not an important part of this class, but I do want to use it right here. So what this means is that a 1 eV electron, if I put in the mass of the electron and solve for the velocity, has a velocity of 596 meters per second. The momentum of this electron is 9 times 10 to the minus 31 kilograms, that's the basic mass of the electron, times this velocity, 5 times 596 meters per second. So here in the middle of page 14, we find that momentum is equal to 5 times 10 to the minus 28 kilogram meters per second. So now the wavelength of that electron is going to be Planck's constant of 6.6 times 10 to the minus 34 divided by this 5 times 10 to the minus 28. That's 1.3 times 10 to the minus 6 microns. That's 1 micrometer. That's 1 times 10 to the minus 6 meters. That is no longer so crazy in terms of being small. A human hair has a size of about 100 microns. So when things are at the size of a micron, we actually can observe effects. So one of the implications of de Broglie's statement is that if you have an electron, for example, one eV electron, and you were to send it through something that has a structure on the order where pieces are separated by on the order of a micron or so, that you should see diffraction of the electrons, and you should be able to see interference for electron beams. And sure enough, you really do. In fact, electron microscopes are optical devices, in a sense. They're not using light, but they image things using the wavelength of electrons, which is vastly shorter than the wavelength of visible light. So when you use the wavelength of electrons to image things, you can actually see things that are much, much smaller because the wavelength is so short. And if you go up to higher energy, so if you use electrons that have a higher energy, then you get a smaller and smaller wavelength. So you actually can image things with more and more, with smaller and smaller things. Okay, so now we have this weird situation where we have light as both a wave and a particle, and it turns out that particles are both particles and waves. So welcome to the new world. Page 15. About 1912, I think it was. So this was about 12 years or so before de Broglie's hypothesis, which came out in the mid-1920s. A fellow named Niels Bohr, who's a very famous physicist, constructed a theory of the atom that used the fact that light is a wave. I'm sorry, that light is a particle. And it turns out that his model of the atom, when I describe it to you, will contain some ad hoc elements, things that don't really make sense. But if you use the concept of de Broglie's matter waves, it turns out that these ideas do make sense. So let me paint the picture for you, and then I'll motivate what led Bohr to this particular model. So if we go to page 16, here is the idea of the Bohr model of the atom. In the Bohr model of the atom, all of the positive charge in the atom exists in a very tiny nucleus at the center of the atom. And the electrons orbit this tiny nucleus in circles. But not every circle is allowed. Only certain discrete circles are allowed. And since the energy of the electron depends on the radius of the circle, that means that the electron can only have a certain set of discrete energies inside the atom. In this model, the electric force holds the electron basically on a circle. It's attracting it toward the nucleus. So you can imagine spinning a rock around your head in a sling, and it is the leather of the sling that is pulling the rock toward the center and accelerating it toward the center, which is what holds it on your head or around your head and keeps it from going off into space. So it's the electric force that's doing that for the electron here. What is particularly, I mean, the idea of having a nuclear atom, an atom where the positive charge is at the center, wasn't necessarily new with Bohr, but what was new was this idea of discrete orbits. Because classically, what happens if the electron is orbiting a positive charge, if you solve this problem classically, what happens is that as the electron rotates around the nucleus, it should radiate away some of its energy in the form of light, which means it loses energy and it slowly spirals into the nucleus and eventually hits the nucleus and the atom basically disappears. So this is really quite a step. Bohr said that in spite of what we know about classical physics, I'm going to hypothesize that these orbits are stable. And he had his reasons for doing this, as we'll see. So if we go to page 17, I'm going to ignore history for a moment and then motivate this idea of the discrete orbits using the de Broglie wavelength idea. So where the pink A is, we have this picture of the electron moving in a circle about the nucleus, and it is the force always toward the center that keeps the electron, basically its velocity always changing in direction so that it moves around in a circle. I want you to recall the standing waves we saw in class the other day, where we have a wave traveling one direction down a string, it reflects, and then for certain particular frequencies the reflection adds constructively through interference with the incoming wave, and you get resonance, we call it, where you get these beautiful standing wave patterns. But if you recall, as I was changing the frequency of the waves traveling down the string, only certain frequencies fit this particular condition. So we only got resonance at very particular frequencies. You can think, now that we have the de Broglie idea of the electron being a wave, you can think of the electron basically going around a full circle, and you could imagine if it's a wave, then only for particular circles will that wave be able to travel around the circle and interfere constructively with itself or resonate. If I go to other frequencies or other circles, you'll find that it will destructively interfere and you'll get sort of a jumbled mess like we did with the standing wave on the string. So you can picture this on page 18. You can imagine instead of having our string with standing waves set out linearly before you, imagine if we could sort of curl it into a circle. In this case, there would be a certain wavelengths would propagate around the circle and add constructively through interference, and you would get a stable pattern, such as shown in picture B. And in certain circumstances, if the wavelength is wrong, you would get destructive interference, say where I have the pink D and E in the picture at the bottom. You can see as the wave has moved around the circle, it interferes destructively with itself, and so that would be an unstable wave. So this is a way of imagining, if you calculate what wavelengths would give stable circular patterns in an atom, you come up with the orbits that Niels Bohr hypothesized are stable in the Bohr model of the atom. Now, it turns out that de Broglie had not come up with his hypothesis at the time Bohr came up with his model of the atom. What excited Bohr was the idea of having these discrete orbitals. We call them orbitals, these circles, by having these discrete states where the electron is stable. So to get a sense of why this was so important, go to slide 19. We know that for circular motion, I think you did this in a recitation. I know we haven't talked about it in lecture, but it was in recitation. For circular motion, the formula, the relationship between the velocity and radius that makes circular motion happen is that the force toward the center is always equal to the mass times the tangential velocity, so tangential to the circle, squared divided by r. And if I quantize the orbits, if I say only certain r's are used, then it's going to mean only certain velocities actually work, which basically is a statement that only certain energies are true. So a way of picturing this, if we go down to the bottom of page 19, the different orbits correspond to different energies for the electron or different potential energies for the electron. And instead of the electron being able to occupy any given energy or any radius, it can only occupy certain discrete ones, which I show in the middle plot as E1, E2, E3. And you can think of the energy of the inner radius as being the lowest energy state, and the energy, if the electron has a bit more energy, it might be an E2 state. If it has a bit more energy, it might be in the orbit E3. So these discrete orbits, we often will call states or states of existence, you can think of them. The reason that Niels Bohr wanted to have these discrete states is in the picture that the photon comes in little packets. He said that when an atom absorbs light, it absorbs light, and when it does, it kicks the electron up from one orbital to a higher energy orbital. If the electron emits light, it emits a packet of energy that is exactly equal to the amount of energy between the two orbits as the electron drops from one energy to another. So at the bottom of page 19, for example, you see the process of an electron making a transition to a lower energy orbit, and in the process, it emits a photon, which I show signified by the symbol gamma, and the energy of that photon is equal to the energy difference of those two orbits. So this electron is going from the third energy level to the second energy level, so the energy of that photon would come off as with a packet of energy equal to E3 minus E2. So why do we care about this? The reason is that that atoms do not emit bands of light. I'm sorry, they do not emit broad swaths of color. They emit very particular frequencies of light. Or another way to think about it, using the E equals H nu idea of the particulate nature of light, atoms only emit discrete energies of, or discrete photon energies, not broad swaths. So if we look at slide 20, this may seem a little bit strange to you, because if you look, for example, at light coming from some source like a lamp, and you pass it through a prism, you see a very smooth spectrum of light. You'll see ranging from, violet to blue to green to yellow to orange to red, and it looks very smooth. You don't see just a few colors. You see a very smooth distribution of color. The thing is, for most sources of light that you see, you're getting light from all sorts of different kinds of processes, atomic processes. There are all sorts of atoms doing things to send out this light. So you get light of all different colors. If you go to the trouble, and I will do a demo for you in class, I guess a week from today, where we'll see this. If you go to the trouble of taking a single type of atom, a single element, so hydrogen gas or neon gas, and you create a light source from that alone, and you then send it through a prism, or there's another device which we'll call a grating, which actually does a better job at spreading light than a prism. But conceptually, you can think of them as the same thing. A grating is basically a super prism. What you find at the bottom of page 20, the observer actually sees only very particular colors, very narrow lines of color coming off. So, you know, a very sharp blue line or a couple of, you know, very sharp orange lines or whatever. Only these discrete colors. So I promised a little while ago this idea of dispersion, this ability to spread light out into its component colors, is a very powerful tool. And here you go. Because it was known well before Bohr that atoms only emitted very particular colors of light, but people really couldn't understand how to model this. They could not reproduce, theoretically, the particular colors that specific atoms emitted. Bohr's model was able to do this for hydrogen, for example. It would reproduce the colors, the very discrete colors, because there are only discrete number of possibilities. So for the hydrogen atom, for example, you have a very particular set of orbits, and an atom is only going to emit light where an electron can jump from one higher orbit down to one lower orbit. And if you have a discrete number of orbits, you're going to have only a discrete number of allowed jumps, and those each correspond to a discrete spectral line, we call it, or a discrete color that comes off of that atom. So if we go to page 21, the Bohr model of the atom turned out to be very important because it works with the quantized nature of the light. Two, it used the nuclear model of the atom, and there was data that had been taken which showed that the positive charge is concentrated at the center, and we'll talk about that soon after we talk about quantum physics. We'll move into nuclear physics, and I'll explain how we knew that. The Bohr model of the atom worked with the quantized nature of light. By that I mean it worked with the picture of light, that light comes in little packets. It explained the discrete spectra of for simply atoms exactly. It reproduced, for example, the hydrogen atom spectrum. By that I mean if you excite the hydrogen atom and you look at the particular colors that come off, this model showed where those colors came from exactly and told you which colors they would be. And so this Bohr model of the atom, as we'll see, is not the last word in our models of atoms, but it actually turns out to be a pretty good way to visualize the atom. Where we're about to go, Bohr's model was semi-classical. I mean, he pictured the electron, more or less he pictured it as a BB moving in circles around, classically around a positive charge. And although the de Broglie hypothesis sort of begins to make that the discrete orbits plausible, it's not really in from the start. Bohr is not really using the wave nature of the electron in this. The next step was to develop a theory of matter and forces that used the wave aspect of light. And that is what we formally know of as quantum mechanics. But the Bohr model, although sort of a mix of classical and quantum ideas, was sort of the first one of those. And although we're about to see a more complex picture of the atom that comes out of full-blown quantum mechanics, the mental picture that you can carry around from the Bohr model is actually pretty useful, and even today. I mean, it's something that I commonly will use in how I think about atoms, if you will. Okay, so I think that takes me to the end of the material I wanted to get through today. I appreciate your patience. I know this is not the most exciting mode of presenting the material. Maybe I should drink more coffee next time. I'll make it a little bit more fun. At any rate, I will see you next week. I hope you have a wonderful fall break. Bye.